Stanza 4. O woods and thickets planted by the hand of my beloved, O green meadow coated bright with flowers, tell me, has he passed by you? Commentary. The soul has made known the manner of preparing oneself to begin this journey, to pursue no longer delights and satisfactions, and to overcome temptations and difficulties through fortitude. This is the practice of self-knowledge, the first requirement for advancing to the knowledge of God. Now, in this stanza, she begins to walk along the way of the knowledge and consideration of creatures, which leads to the knowledge of her beloved, the Creator. On this spiritual road, the consideration of creatures is first in order after the exercise of self-knowledge. The soul thereby advances in the knowledge of God by considering his greatness and excellence manifested in creatures, as is brought out in the passage of St. Paul. The visible things of God are known by the soul through creatures, both visible and invisible. Romans 1:20. She addresses creatures then in this stanza, asking them about her beloved. And it is noteworthy, as St. Augustine says, that the soul's interrogation of creatures is the very consideration of the Creator it has through them. This stanza embodies a meditation upon the elements and other inferior creatures, and on the heavens together with the other material things in them which God created, and also upon the heavenly spirits. O woods and thickets! She calls the elements, earth, water, air, and fire, woods, because, like pleasant woods, they are thickly populated with creatures. She labels these creatures thickets because of their vast number and the notable difference among them in each of the elements. On the earth, there is a countless variety of animals and plants. In the water, numberless kinds of fish. And in the air, a remarkable diversity of birds. And the element fire concurs with the others for the animation and preservation of these creatures. Each kind of animal lives in its element and is placed and planted in it as in the woods and region where it is born and nurtured. Indeed, God commanded this when he created the elements. He ordered the earth to produce the plants and the animals, and the sea and the water, the fish, and he made the air a habitation for birds. Seeing that he has commanded it was done, the soul says in the following verse, planted by the hand of my beloved. This verse contains the following reflection. Only the hand of God, her beloved, was able to create this diversity and grandeur. It is noteworthy that she deliberately says, by the hand of my beloved. Although God often acts through the hand of another, as through those of angels and men, he never created, nor does he carry on this work of creation by any other hand than his own. This reflection on creatures, this observing that they are things made by the very hand of God, her beloved, strongly awakens the soul to love him. She then continues, O green meadow. This verse refers to her reflection upon the heavens. She calls them a green meadow because the created things in them are as a vendor that neither dies nor fades with time, and in them, as in cool, verdant meadows, the just find their recreation and delight. The diversity of the beautiful stars and other heavenly planets is also included in this meditation. The church likewise uses the word green to express heavenly things. In praying to God for the souls of the faithfully departed, she says, speaking to them, May God set you among delightful green places. And she says that this green meadow is also coated bright with flowers. By these flowers, she understands the angels and saintly souls which adorn and beautify that place, like a costly enamel on a vase of fine gold. Tell me, has he passed by you? This question is the reflection mentioned above. It is similar to saying, Tell me of the excellent qualities he has created in you. Stanza 5. Pouring out 1,000 graces, he passed these groves in haste, and having looked at them with his image alone, clothed them in beauty. Commentary. In this stanza, the creatures answer the soul. Their answer, as St. Augustine declares in the same place, is the testimony that they in themselves give the soul of God's grandeur and excellence. It is for this testimony that she asked in her meditation. The substance of this stanza is, God created all things with remarkable ease and brevity, and in them he left some trace of who he is, not only in giving all things being from nothing, but even by endowing them with innumerable graces and qualities, making them beautiful in a wonderful order, an unfailing dependence on one another. All of this he did through his own wisdom, the Word, his only begotten Son, by whom he created them. She then says, pouring out 1,000 graces. These 1,000 graces, she says, he was pouring out refer to the numberless multitude of creatures. She records the high number, 1,000, to indicate their multitude. She calls them graces because of the many graces he has endowed creatures with. Pouring these out, that is, stocking the whole world with them. He passed these groves in haste. To pass the groves is to create the elements, which are here termed groves. She declares that he passed by them, pouring out 1,000 graces, because he adorned them with all the creatures that are favored with graces. And in addition, he poured out on them the 1,000 graces by giving them the power to concur in generation and conservation. And she says he passed by, because creatures are like a trace of God's passing. Through them one can track down his grandeur, might, wisdom, and other divine attributes. She declares that this passing was in haste. creatures are the lesser works of God, because he made them as though in passing. The greater works, in which he manifested himself more, and to which he gave greater attention, were those of the incarnation of the Word and the mysteries of the Christian faith. Compared to these, all the others were done as though in passing and with haste. And having looked at them with his image alone, clothed them in beauty. Saint Paul says, "The Son of God is the splendor of his glory and the image of his substance." Hebrews 1:3. It should be known that only with this figure, his Son, did God look at all things, that is, he communicated to them their natural being, many natural graces and gifts, and made them complete and perfect. As is said in Genesis, God looked at all things that he made, and they were very good. Genesis 1:31. To look and behold that they were very good was to make them very good in the Word, his Son. Not only by looking at them did he communicate natural being and graces, as we said, but also with this image of his Son alone. He clothed them in beauty by imparting to them supernatural being. This he did when he became man and elevated human nature in the beauty of God, and consequently all creatures, since in human nature he was united with them all. Accordingly, the Son of God proclaimed, "If I be lifted up from the earth, I will elevate all things to me." John 12:32. And in this elevation of all things, through the incarnation of his Son, and through the glory of his resurrection, according to the flesh, the Father did not merely beautify creatures partially, but rather, we can say, clothe them wholly in beauty and dignity. Stanza 6, Introduction. In addition to all of this, from the viewpoint of contemplative experience, it should be known that in the living contemplation and knowledge of creatures, the soul sees such fullness of graces, powers, and beauty with which God has endowed them, that seemingly all are arrayed in wonderful beauty and natural virtue. This beauty and virtue is derived from above and imparted by that infinite supernatural beauty of the image of God. His look clothes the world and all the heavens with beauty and gladness. Just as he also, upon opening his hand, fills every animal with blessing, as David says in Psalm 144. The soul, wounded with love through a trace of the beauty of her beloved, which she has known through creatures, and anxious to see that invisible beauty which caused this visible beauty, declares in the following verses, "Ah, who has the power to heal me? Now wholly surrender yourself. Do not send me any more messengers, for they cannot tell me what I must hear." Commentary. Since creatures gave the soul signs of her beloved and showed within themselves traces of his beauty and excellence, love increased in her, and consequently sorrow at his absence. Since she is conscious that nothing can cure her grief other than her beloved's presence and the sight of him, she asks him in this stanza, distrusting any other remedy, to surrender his presence that she may possess him. She asks him that from henceforth he no longer detain her with any other knowledge, communications, and traces of his excellence, for these increase her desire and suffering, rather than bring her satisfaction. This the will is content with nothing less than his presence and the sight of him. She asks, therefore, if it be his will, that he truly surrender himself to her in complete and perfect love. She says, "Ah, who has the power to heal me?" This is like saying, "Among all worldly delights and sensible satisfactions and spiritual gratification and sweetness, there is certainly nothing with the power to heal me, nothing to satisfy me." And then she adds, "Now wholly surrender yourself." It is noteworthy that any soul with authentic love cannot be satisfied until it really possesses God. Everything else not only fails to satisfy it, but, as we said, increases the hunger and appetite to see him as he is. Every glimpse of the Beloved received through knowledge or feeling or any other communication, which is like a messenger bringing to the soul news of who he is, further increases and awakens her appetite, like the crumbs given to a famished man. Finding it difficult to be delayed by so little, she pleads, "Now wholly surrender yourself." All the knowledge of God possible in this life, however extensive it may be, is inadequate, for it is only partial knowledge and very remote. Essential knowledge of him is the real knowledge for which the soul asks here, unsatisfied by these other communications. She says next, "Do not send me any more messengers." This is like saying, "Do not let my knowledge of you, communicated through these messengers of news and sentiments about you, any longer be so measured, so remote and alien to what my soul desires. How well you know, my spouse, that messengers redoubled the sorrow of one who grieves over your absence. First, through knowledge, they enlarge the wound. Second, they seem to postpone your coming. From now on, do not send me this remote knowledge. If up to this time I could be content with it, because I did not have much knowledge or love of you, now the intensity of my love cannot be satisfied with these messages. Therefore, now wholly surrender yourself." More clearly, this is like saying, "My Lord, my spouse, you have given yourself to me partially. Now may you give me yourself more completely. You have revealed yourself to me as through fissures in a rock. Now may you give me that revelation more clearly. You have communicated by means of others, as if joking with me. Now may you truly grant me a communication of yourself by yourself. In your visits, at times, it seems, you are about to give me the jewel of possessing you. But when I become aware of this possession, I discover that I do not have it, for you hid this jewel as if you had given it jokingly. Now wholly surrender yourself by giving yourself entirely to all of me, that my entire soul may have complete possession of you. Do not send me any more messengers. They cannot tell me what I must hear." This verse is equivalent to saying, I desire complete knowledge of you, and they have neither knowledge nor ability to tell you entirely. Nothing in heaven or on earth can give the soul the knowledge she desires of you. Thus they cannot tell me what I must hear. Instead of these other messengers, may you, then, be both the messenger and the message. Stanza 7. All who are free, tell me 1,000 graceful things of you. All wound me more and leave me dying. Ah, I do not know what behind their stammering. Commentary. In the previous stanza, the soul has shown her sickness or wound of love for the bridegroom, caused by the knowledge irrational creatures gave of him. In this stanza, she asserts that she is wounded with love because of another higher knowledge that she receives of the beloved through rational creatures, angels and men, creatures more noble than the others. She asserts, too, that she is not merely wounded, but also dying of love. This dying of love is due to an admirable immensity these creatures disclose to her, yet not completely. Because this immensity is indescribable, she calls it an ah, I don't know what, and because of it, the soul is dying of love. We can deduce that in this matter of love, there exists 3 ways of suffering for the beloved, corresponding to the 3 kinds of knowledge of him. The first is called a wound. It is the mildest and heals the most quickly, as does a wound. This wound arises from the knowledge the soul receives from creatures, the lowest of God's works. The bride of the canticle refers to this wound, which we also call sickness, and saying, I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him that I am sick with love. Canticle 5:8. By the daughters of Jerusalem she refers to this creatures. The second is called a sore wound and cuts more deeply into the soul than the simple wound. As a result, it is a longer lasting because it is like a wound that has now become sore, from which she feels she is indeed sorely wounded by love. This sore wound is produced in the soul by knowledge of the incarnation of the Word and of the mysteries of faith, since these are more remarkable works of God, embodying in themselves a greater love than that shown forth in creatures. They produce in the soul a more intense love. Thus, if the first is like a wound, the second is like a sore wound, which lasts longer. Speaking of this to the soul in the Canticle of the Canticles, the bridegroom says, You have wounded my heart, my sister, with one of your eyes and with one hair of your neck. The eye refers to faith in the incarnation of the bridegroom, and the hair signifies love for this very incarnation.